Hello again, constant listeners. Geared up to bring you yet another episode, another memorable installment of our happy place known as the Farm Metal. This is Nick Deolius speaking, and I get to host this congregation. Now, if you're a first-time listener, well, now you know where to find us so that you can join the ranks of the constant listeners. In last episode, I failed to mention a happy Rosh Hashanah to all my Jewish friends out there, and I've got many, including those since I've known since childhood. But I get to remedy at least some of that forgetfulness by wishing my buddies of the Jewish faith a thoughtful Yom Kippur in a few days from the first airing of this episode 177. This episode's sports dedication is going to fall within the unconventional category, one of the odder dedications that we've seen through Farm Metal history. However, the dedication subject you're likely to be familiar with, not because of what he did in the arena of sport, but because of what he accomplished on the big screen as a movie actor. His name was Burt Young, but most people know him from the most famous role that he played in his film career, that of Rocky Balboa's brother-in-law, the grumpy Polly. Burt Young was born in gritty Queens, and he certainly brought a brand to his roles on film that reflected that upbringing. The New York Times referenced it as a weary gravitas and bare-knuckled demeanor. I described the brand as more of a cranky curmudgeon when it came to his typical roles, an SOB, but often a lovable SOB. In the case of Polly in the movie Rocky, he was what Bob Seger would call a beautiful loser. The movies he appeared in are some of the greatest films of the 20th century. Most people often forget his roles besides Rocky. Burt Young played tough guys in films like Chinatown, Once Upon a Time in America, and of course, Rocky, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award. Young had the legendary acting teacher Lee Strasberg as his mentor, and it showed in his convincing roles. Strasberg once called Mr. Young a library of emotions. Now, you know you're good when a legend in your field praises you like that. Burt Young indeed had an awesome acting career. But how does that land him into the Farm Metal as a sports dedication subject? Well, that's because of what Burt Young accomplished before he made it on the big screen. And that's the backstory that most people, including film fans, don't realize. As I said, he grew up in a working-class neighborhood in Queens, and he was on the streets getting into trouble at a young age. So his dad made him go to another high school, and he quickly got thrown out of that one, and then got thrown out of yet another school. So then his dad took some drastic action. In Young's own words, "Finally, it was the Marines at 16, my pop fibbing my age to get me in." Imagine that. Now, he started boxing in the Marine Corps, and before you knew it, Young had a successful and brief professional boxing career, where, by the way, he was coached by another legend, this one in boxing, the one and only Cus D'Amato. D'Amato was the boxing trainer and manager who brought along two names at the top of the boxing tree, Floyd Patterson, and then later, most famously, of course, Mike Tyson. Young had a win-loss record of about 17-1, and I say about because his own accounts vary depending on who was interviewing him during what year. When he eventually quit the ring and took up acting, he once did a little promo with Muhammad Ali in the 1970s, and he was a sparring partner for Canadian boxer George Chevallo, who fought, by the way, he fought Ali, Frazier, and George Foreman in his career. That was during a golden age of heavyweight boxing. Now, if you want to dig deeper on Burt Young's boxing career, good luck, because it's going to be a challenge. He was always somewhat vague about details, and he boxed under a different name versus his adopted screen name, Burt Young. But no matter what the details, we dedicate episode 177 to Burt Young, who made notable achievements in two professions, boxing and acting, and who had the benefit of studying under two legends, Cus D'Amato and Lee Strasberg, and who left his mark in some of the most memorable films of the 20th century. We lost Burt a year ago yesterday, October 8th, 2023. Thus, he's not only a fitting dedication, but also a timely one for this episode. I thought you'd enjoy that dedication. As I said, a bit unconventional, but nevertheless compelling. Now, Burt Young made his name in Hollywood, which of course sits within California. And we can start our connections for the week by jumping to the Golden State and talking about all the negative consequences that manifest when we see the state or government deciding to thrust itself into the private sector and free market. And it's going to serve as a theme for the episode's connections, as you will see. And in California, that theme is occurring across a wide swath of industries, unfortunately. But one in particular is most troubling, and that's what's going on with media. In mid-August, Google and the California legislature struck a $180 million deal to fund what will become government-backed news organizations. Local news outlets have been struggling everywhere, including California, because their business models are looking increasingly obsolete. Advertising revenue is drying up, and people no longer are willing to pay for subscriptions when they can access orders of magnitude more information for free online. Plus, many view traditional media as less than objective these days. Now, that's what disruptive technology and changing trends are going to do to industries or subsectors within industries. We see it all the time. The horse buggy back in the day was made obsolete by the automobile, and the same looks to be occurring for traditional TV and print media when it comes to news. But not so fast, says California state government. It wants to require large internet platforms like Google to pay news publishers a share of advertising revenue. At first, Google hated the idea, as you can imagine, but then it looked like a legal fight was going to ensue with state government, and that would be costly for Google in more ways than one, because when you try to fight the government, you typically end up losing in more ways than just money, and with respect to just the discrete decision. You risk lawfare with the whole of government lined up against you. So Google gave up the fight and made a deal with the state. Governor Newsom in California called the deal with Google a great one that would ensure the survival of newsrooms. Perhaps, but it's just that they will no longer be independent journalists in those newsrooms. The deal of collusion between Google and California government turns what was objective journalism in the past into a spokesentity for government in the future. Of the $180 million in the agreement, Google pays $110 million, and the state ponies up $70 million over 5 years. That money's going to go into local news outlets and journalism programs, and the money will be managed through a fund, which is going to be administered by the University of Cal Berkeley's Journalism School. Gee, I wonder what political persuasion that journalism school leans towards. To add insult to injury to middle-class taxpayers, Google, under the agreement, will be able to deduct what is considered to be, believe it or not, a charitable contribution from its federal and state taxes. So there you have it. California government threatens to sue Google if Google doesn't accept being extorted by giving up some of its revenue. Google cuts a deal to avoid government retaliation and ongoing legal battles. And now news in California is brought and paid for by state government and big tech. If you're relying on local news reporting to hold government and big business accountable in California, you may need to reassess that reliance. Now, that's what's going on in California and the tech industry and media. Let's make our next connection to a similar example, but this time in New York State with the energy industry and electricity. In June of this year, New York State signed a contract to buy electricity from two large wind farms, both off the coast of Long Island. The power will begin to be delivered to Brooklyn and Long Island in about 2 to 3 years. The state agreed to pay between $146 and $155 per megawatt hour for the electricity from these wind projects. And those prices are at least four times the average grid cost paid over the past year. So New Yorkers are about to get robbed and hosed through their utility bills. Why such a high price? Well, to be blunt, offshore wind, it's a losing proposition, and it can't be competitive on its own. So government in places like New York, it agrees to pay offshore wind providers their break-even cost. And that break-even cost is insanely high, and it keeps rising because offshore wind, as I said, it's a creeping disaster in a competitive market. What's extra interesting about this topic is that the U.S. government has a view on what the break-even cost of offshore wind is, and it says it's around $130 a megawatt hour, not counting government subsidy, and about $100 a megawatt hour after allowing for subsidies such as tax credits. Investment bank Lazard is even more optimistic and bullish than the federal government when it comes to offshore wind, and it says break-even costs for offshore wind are somewhere between $50 and $80 a megawatt hour. So after adjusting for these huge subsidies showered upon wind power, New York should be paying somewhere around $50 to $100 a megawatt hour for offshore wind using break-even cost estimates, in that range that I just quoted from the federal government and from Lazard. So why is New York State agreeing to pay about $150 a megawatt hour for electricity from these projects? That's 50% to 300% more than the experts' break-even estimates. And it's not as if the project sponsors are hurting for money. The owner-operators of the two farms are two of the top five global wind farm investors and operators in the world. One is Norway's state oil company, ironically, while the other was Denmark's previous state oil company. Classic irony. Now, both are mammoth organizations and have access to enormous financial resources. A few years ago, New York agreed to take electricity from one of these offshore projects and pay just over $107 a megawatt hour. But the company wanted more money after the deal was struck and threatened to cancel the project unless New York renegotiated its offtake price. And the other owner-operator at the second offshore wind project followed the exact same playbook. And before you know it, it worked. New York State agreed to redo and pay higher prices, and New York ratepayers and taxpayers are going to foot the bill. And because there's such a significant spread between what New York is paying for these wind projects and what the break-even costs are estimated to be for offshore wind, it means there's only one of two things occurring. Either the true break-even costs of offshore wind are anywhere from 50% to 100% higher than what the federal government and Lazard claim, or these projects are going to earn massive profits at the expense of taxpayers and ratepayers. Or wait, maybe there's a third possibility. Maybe both things are true. And by the way, the average wholesale price of power in New York was about $36 per megawatt hour. That's perhaps the clearest indication that if the free market is left to provide electricity to ratepayers, New Yorkers would be paying much, much lower prices and taxpayers would not be forced to subsidize multi-billion dollar foreign entities. But New York state government, along with the federal government, insists on state intervention of the private sector and in a free market when it comes to the energy industry. And this is going to be the types of outcomes that you end up with. Hey, how about some good news when it comes to this troubling crisis of government across the spectrum, insisting on overstepping its bounds and intervening into the private sector and free markets and individual rights? Our next connection summarizes how one of the checks and balances laid out in our Constitution, that of the judiciary and its responsibility to hold the executive branch in check, is working. The bad news is that the judiciary has been working overtime the past few years because the federal government's executive branch, aka the administrative state, has been looking to expand and usurp authority anywhere and anytime that it can. Check out this laundry list of legal defeats that the current administration has suffered in the courts. And thanks to the Wall Street Journal for some helpful data that I used to put this together. We'll start with the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC. It tried to classify broadband providers as common carriers in its zest to control the arena of net neutrality. Now, the Sixth Circuit of Appeals blocked it, saying that regulators need express direction from Congress on such a consequential rule before proceeding with the rule, which the FTC didn't have. Imagine that. And that wasn't the first loss for the FCC when it came to overreach. 2 years ago, the DC Circuit vacated part of an FCC rule that required broadcasters to verify the sponsors of programs by checking two federal sources. The FCC is not alone. The Department of Education, it suffered a pair of key losses in the courts. And that's good news, by the way, for students and taxpayers. Now, the most famous is the Supreme Court's ruling that President Biden's plan to forgive $400 billion in student loans usurped Congress's power of the purse. The administration then came up with the SAVE plan, which capped payments at 5% of discretionary income and forgave balances from anywhere from 10 to 20 years, which was effectively debt forgiveness under a different name or under a different scheme. And the Eighth Circuit recently put that plan on hold with a nationwide injunction. And the Department of Education's Title IX rule, that suffered a defeat. Six federal judges this year alone blocked new Title IX rules from going into effect across 26 states. One judge called it a violation of government employees' First Amendment rights and said that the result of the proposed rule was arbitrary and capricious. Ouch. Then there is, of course, the EPA. Its Clean Power Plan was vacated when it came to regulating greenhouse gas emissions. The Supreme Court referenced the EPA's attempt as an unheralded power, representing a transformative expansion in its regulatory authority. And that was a 6-3 decision. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that dry land on private citizens' property doesn't constitute waters of the United States under the Clean Water Act, just because it might have a tangential connection to a navigable body of water. Now, that would seem obvious to any of us, but you can see with how the EPA was wanting to define waters of the United States, that common sense often does not apply to critical definitions. And the Supreme Court in June issued a stay on the EPA's good neighbor rule that would restrict ozone emissions in certain states because of alleged downwind effects on other states. The court said the EPA's plan would likely run afoul of long-settled standards. The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, it isn't doing well in court either. A federal judge in late summer struck down a ban on non-compete agreements for employees, and the judge that struck it down said that the FTC lacked legal authority and that the rule was unreasonably overbroad without a reasonable explanation. Sort of love that explanation from the judge. In a really important case involving administrative law judges, the Supreme Court last year ruled in a rare 9-0 decision that companies can take constitutional challenges to federal court rather than having to first go through administrative agency tribunals that always seem to rule for the agency. Imagine that. In early 23, a federal judge ruled that the FTC didn't meet the standards of proof when it wanted to pursue an antitrust case against tech giant Meta. And later that year, a federal judge dismissed the FTC's attempt to block a Microsoft merger, that with Activision. So ironically, big tech, and we've talked about this in the past on the Far Middle, often a supporter of big government, is starting to suffer the consequences of state overreach, and the courts are ending up protecting big tech from the Frankenstein monster that it helped jolt to life. But the agency that suffered the most in the courts when it comes to the insatiable drive for usurping power and authority has been the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC. This summer, the Fifth Circuit ruled that the SEC's rescission of a proxy advisory rule, that it was arbitrary and capricious, and that involved the SEC's attempt to protect a duopoly of proxy advisory firms, Glass Lewis and ISS. In the same month, the same Fifth Circuit blocked an SEC rule that would micromanage contracts between private funds and their investors, saying the agency lacked statutory authority. A Utah judge imposed sanctions on the SEC for what the judge referenced as bad faith conduct in a crypto case. The SEC was ordered to pay $1.8 million in fees, and the case was dismissed. And then at the end of last year, the Fifth Circuit, they were at it once again, when it vacated an SEC rule that required extensive public disclosures when a company wants to repurchase its own shares. The court said the SEC failed to conduct a proper cost-benefit analysis and that it acted once again arbitrarily and capriciously. Now, I'm a proponent of share buybacks to return capital to shareholders under the proper circumstances and when the math is right, so I took a particular interest in that decision. Now, you add all this up across what, just five government agencies that we mentioned on the federal level, and you can see that there is a covert but serious campaign going on when it comes to the administrative state looking to expand its power and authority. And in that campaign, the judicial branch of government has done, in my opinion, a tremendous job of holding the bureaucrat and the administrative state in check. Because of that, every individual, every business, and free enterprise advocate, they all should be extremely grateful. Now, one final note on this connection. We need to understand and call this for what it is. This behavior by the administrative state is lawlessness. It's repeated behavior that shows the administrative state intends to disregard the law as it seeks to impose its will on the citizens of this country without any authority or consent from the governed. The best term for that is indeed lawlessness. Let's conclude this episode with a connection tying together key aspects of our key dots that we made connections to. Burt Young in his acting career appeared in films that showed the dark side of human nature, like Chinatown, and the ability of the underdog or the individual to stand up even in defeat, as was the case in the film Rocky. We covered a series of connections where the bully of bureaucratic government and state intervention pushes its way into the private sector and into the individual and its decision-making to the extent where it sows massive damage. Well, we have a connection that wraps this series of connections and ties all of these connections together. And it's an author who died 100 years ago this summer. His name was Joseph Conrad, which appears to be the name of an Englishman or American, but Joseph Conrad was European, and English was his third language, but he mastered it in his writings like few others. He was of Polish descent and was the son of a failed revolutionary. He was exiled in childhood to northern Russia, and he fled Russia in his teens to Western Europe. He despised Russia, and during the Soviet Civil War in 1920, he described Poland as a defender of civilization against the dangers of Russian barbarism. He lamented the moral corruption of Russia, which should serve as a sobering reminder of the moral corruption of the administrative state when it looks to illegally expand its power. He was close friends with another literary great, Henry James, and Henry James understood that Conrad brought to bear experiences that other writers could not match. He said to Conrad, "No one has known the things you know, and you have, as the artist of the whole matter, an authority that no one has approached." I mentioned Conrad was a writer who embraced dark themes and visions. Heart of Darkness is, of course, his most famous work, and if you haven't read it, I would highly recommend it for two reasons. First, and obviously, it's one of the 20th century's great books. Well, technically, it was published in 1899, but close enough. But secondly, what Conrad described in the Congo, unfortunately, is truer in many ways today than it was when he wrote that story back when Belgium's oppression of the Congo was ongoing. And much of the modern pain being inflicted upon the Democratic Republic of Congo stems from climate change policies and forcing things like offshore wind upon grids. If you think it's bad with New Yorkers being extorted in their power bills, consider what's going on with kids working in open pit mines in places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo to extract the stuff needed for wind and solar and electric vehicle batteries. It's shameful. Many of you may know this, but if you don't, I'll mention it just in case. The Francis Ford Coppola film, the classic movie Apocalypse Now, it's based off of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. The character played by Marlon Brando in the film, Kurtz, is also the name of the key character in Heart of Darkness. And although Apocalypse Now occurs in Vietnam's jungles in, what, the early 1970s, while Heart of Darkness occurs in Congo's jungles during a much earlier time, Coppola basically tells the story of Heart of Darkness in his film. Now, some critics panned that film, but most agreed, like Conrad's novel, the film was a disturbing treatment of the darkness potentially inherent in all human hearts. What I really liked about the book Heart of Darkness is that Conrad challenged that popular concept of progress back then, and he highlighted how what was being labeled as progress in places like Europe was actually resulting in horror in places like the Congo. Civilized man and civilized governments, they can be capable of imposing horror under cover of moral superiority. Interestingly, Conrad was somewhat of an environmentalist back in his day, and he was highly critical of the exploitation of African rubber, which served as a basis and came out clearly in Heart of Darkness. He had similar themes with silver in South America in another one of his books, Nostromo, as well as critiquing the exploitation of East Indies of coal in Victory. All of those, by the way, I believe have been made into films if you want to check them out. Joseph Conrad was highly respected not just by his friend Henry James. He influenced T.S. Eliot, as well as one of my all-time favorites, George Orwell. Orwell said that Conrad had a greater political understanding than any English writer. How about that praise? Here's a parting thought from Joseph Conrad to tie back into our connections and themes for this episode when it comes to state intervention that was originally justified under noble causes, but then turns into something quite damaging and bad. He said, "The scrupulous and the just, the noble, humane, and devoted natures, the unselfish and intelligent, may begin a movement, but it passes away from them. They are not the leaders of a revolution. They are its victims, the victims of disgust, of disenchantment, often of remorse. Hopes grotesquely betrayed, ideals caricatured, that is the definition of revolutionary success." Hey, let's heed that thought from Joseph Conrad. Don't be too eager or easily swayed when it comes to government or bureaucratic promises of saving the planet, furthering education, or helping the downtrodden through state control. the actual results may make things much worse. That's all I got for this week, and until next week, stay connected to that far middle.